Hello and welcome to Race Against the Machine, your irreverent source for discourse on all things related to race, racism, and what it do. My name is Scott Woods, co-hosting here with my man, Aaron No Name. Aaron, what is up?
Oh man, it's a new day.
aren't you optimistic? It's a new day. Snow on the ground. It's almost pure. So we wanted to do, we were actually just sitting here talking about our respective breakfasts today. And I'm all amped up on coffee. So this may go quick. I don't know. We'll see. I may not have to do any editing on this one.
I got to let my tolerance drop a little. So I'm not drinking it on the weekends.
So now, hold up. Are you, since like it's pandemic time, do you find that you're drinking more during your days, or is it about the same?
Coffee?
Yeah.
Or just drinking?
Coffee. I won't put your business in the street.
It's about the same. It's probably about the same. A little more. Just because, you know, I don't want to waste the pot, so.
Right.
I'll go back down and be like, oh, there's a little extra. Let's dust it off, you know.
But, yeah, I'd be like, I like make this whole like 10 cup pot. And I'd be like, well, I guess I got to drink it all, right?
Right. Right. You got to drink it. Usually my dust off the pot cup of coffee involves Bailey's though as well.
See, I thought I was doing something with some flavored cream.
No. Nope. So, my first two cups are really just an excuse to get to the Bailey's cup. It's really what it ends up being.
Nice.
Yeah.
Well, today we're going to do an episode that's largely going to be about the new administration's executive orders. So, Biden is in, so we pulled that off.
Yeah,
and have we done a show since the inauguration? I don't think so.
No, I don't think we did.
Yeah, do we need to say anything about the inauguration? I hadn't planned to, but I don't know if there's something we need to get off our chest about the inauguration.
Besides Garth singing "Amazing Grace."
Ooh. I don't know who thought that one up.
Such an example of white mediocrity. Like, this is what you do for a living. And there's a career politician in the stands that could get up and do it better than you.
I just figured they booked him because they didn't want to outshine the poet.
I guess. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, that's obviously not what happened, but yeah.
I think they're trying to, that was their first attempt at healing.
Mm-hmm. Reaching across the aisle, as it were.
Reaching across the culture wars.
Yeah, they like country music.
Yeah, let's get Garth up here so he can forget to shake the vice president's hand. Not to be reminded. It's like everything was just on display in that moment, in my opinion. It was all
right.
Dolly Parton wasn't available.
Oh,
she could do it. She can sing at least.
Yeah, right. She'd have been dope.
Yeah,
my mother would have loved that. She's a big Dolly Parton fan for some reason. I think because she's from the country, but yeah.
Dolly keeps it pretty real. It's hard to not be.
She does.
Yeah.
Maybe I have one other comment, maybe two more comments about the inauguration. So Michelle Obama was stunning. That's all I'm going to say about that. Anything else would be creepy. And you know, kudos to the poet, Gorman, getting in that career blow pretty early. So
no doubt. Yeah.
Yeah. There's only been 6 inaugural poets ever, and 4 of them have been poets of color. Which is pretty, that's a pretty good stat.
right? Yeah. Yeah.
We represent when it comes to inaugural poetry.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
You gotta give the people something when they turn out and vote for you like that.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, we got that entertainment slot, you know, so that's cool. Yeah. As a poet yourself, have you peeped much of the criticism of her poem?
No.
Oh, good for you.
Are people critiquing the poem?
Are you kidding? Absolutely. Yeah, you know, like lots of poets, obviously, right?
I mean,
I would say a lot. I would say a fraction. You know, most poets have enough sense to just let it go.
I mean, I always, like, you know how it is. You hear enough poems and, like, when someone is doing one, you're just kind of critiquing in your head a little bit, like, as it goes, you know. But I didn't think it was bad at all. I thought she did a good job.
Yeah, so, like, you know, occasional poetry in general is not work that should be held up to the same standard as...
Yes.
All other manner of poetry, probably, right?
Yeah. Like, it's its own genre.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. It has a completely different mission than every other poetry form, right?
Right.
And that could be, you know, a funeral, a wedding, an inauguration, whatever the occasion is. But it actually has a name, right? That's why they call it occasional poetry.
Yeah.
And as far as those kinds of poems go, I mean, it was an occasional poem. To me, that's not something you should ever really be critiquing, like in the same breath as other poems.
Right. So,
to me, the reaction to that would be, if you didn't like the poem that she did, like as a poet, if you didn't like the poem, then you probably just shouldn't say anything. Right. Just don't. It reminds me of this time, like years. This is a long time ago. I don't know if you remember this kid, Maddie Stepanek. I think was his name. He was a little kid in a wheelchair and he wrote poems.
Okay.
And he published like 3 books of poems.
Hmm.
And then he passed away because he had like some disease. So he passed away young, very young.
Yeah.
I remember right around the time, I don't know, maybe like his 3rd book had come out or something. And like I had critiqued it online. Jesus. I was like, yeah, this poetry is really... Whew, it's really bad, you know. And I mean, I knew what I was getting into, you know what I'm saying? It's a kid. Uh-huh. I mean, like at the time, I think he might have been 9 or 10, you know. So it's a lot like grading the art on your refrigerator, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, absolutely.
But I couldn't help myself at the time. This was, again, this was a long time. I would never do this now.
Right, right.
But back then I was like, yeah, I'm going in on this kid's poetry. And that was poor form.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, it's not gonna work out well for you.
No. And so this reminds me a lot of that, not for her age, just because it's an occasional poem. Something too, though, like this whole infantilizing of her was kind of ridiculous too, right? Like they were talking about her like she's a teen poet, like she's 15 or 16. I'm like, this girl's 22 years old.
Yeah,
you know, she go to college, she's been in college, what are you talking about?
Right.
There's no getting around that, I guess.
No, you're not going to get around that. Yeah, occasional poems to me always remind me of like when somebody really believes in something or feels something strongly and they like, they kind of want to give a speech about it and they're like, I wrote this poem. And then they start reading it and you're like, okay, it's only kind of a poem, but okay.
Right.
You know what I mean? You don't really like jump in and critique that. And to me, that's what occasional poetry really is. It's not, it's like half poem, half public speaking. It's a whole, it's its own little thing. It's not, you know.
Absolutely.
And as far as that goes, I thought it was really good. Like for what, for that
occasion
kind of thing that it is.
Yeah.
I thought she did good. There were only a couple of moments where I was like, eh, I wouldn't have said it like that. Or she needs to skip that part. Red pen. You know, there's like maybe 3 or 4 moments where I thought that over. What, 5 minutes?
Right.
For me, like I'm a highly critical person, so that's pretty good. Like that's
a really good ratio.
You know? Yeah.
I remember being asked to write a poem for my grandmother's funeral. It was the first time my family had asked me to write a poem for an occasion, as I recall. And it was not a poem that I would publish or even read ever again. right? Outside of that context. But everybody really appreciated it, and they were, you know, they felt it and blah, blah, blah. And then I just kind of kept getting that gig, right? So every time someone would pass away, I would be asked to do a poem, which was fun. I mean, I embraced that charge.
Yeah.
But I would never, it would never occur to me to do anything else with those poems. They reminded me of like reading this book by Haki Madhubuti. He had done a collection of poems. Many of them were occasional poems. And I was like, ooh, you're brave. Well, anyhow, I guess we should get to the business. Oh, is there anything else about the inauguration?
No, I didn't have anything else that hasn't been said. A lot was said, so.
Right. Well, I guess we should get into the business of why we're here.
Indeed.
So on day one of Biden's administration, he signed several executive orders, presidential orders, right?
Indeed.
The question that we want to kind of interrogate today is, how many of these things apply to Black people directly? Now, he's done executive orders in various amounts for most of the days that he's been in office already, right? So, like, he has at least about 7 days worth of orders that take you up through his 9th day in office. So apparently there might have been like a weekend when he wasn't signing orders or something.
Right.
But on day one, he signed several orders, one of which, at least in name, speaks to racial equity, right, as they label it. And so something that had kind of been floating around in the public discourse was whether or not the administration had done anything for Black people yet, right? So, like, that was, like, day two. It was like, okay, what you done for Black people? Boom, we got you here. You know, where's my mule? I don't expect 40 acres on day one, but right. Where's my mule?
Right.
And so we'll look at him. We'll just kind of look at what he did on day one. And we'll go day by day, and then we'll just kind of talk about what occurs to us to talk about it.
Okay.
So to answer that initial question about, you know, what Biden did on day one for Black people, the answer, I'm just going to say it plainly, is not much, right?
Not much, right.
Now, I do feel compelled to offer a caveat here where, a couple of caveats. One, it's day one. And two, he has to, I'll say he, but I mean they. He has to do a lot of cleanup.
Indeed.
Right?
Indeed. Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of digging to be done.
A lot. And so there are going to be executive orders here that seem pretty elementary, right? Things that are a given.
Right.
That because Trump was so bad cannot be assumed to be a given. And we'll talk about that a little bit in detail. Here's what happened on day one. Are you ready?
Yes.
So 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17 executive orders on day one.
Damn.
Right. Now, the news was making a lot of noise about at least four of these being related to race, racism, equity, that kind of thing. So let's look at them.
Okay.
The first one we'll talk about was a memorandum freezing approval of rules passed in the final days of Trump's presidency. Obviously, that's just an executive order that says we don't have to pay attention to whatever Donald Trump was doing that last week.
Yeah.
Right. Or at least we need to look into it before we go implementing it.
Right.
So that doesn't have anything really to do with us. The bar is, does it have a direct effect on Black life collectively?
Yes.
Right.
Right.
The second one was rejoining the Paris Agreement on climate change. No. The next one, and here we go. And this is when we're into it. an executive order to promote racial equity. So obviously this is the quote unquote black one, yeah. Right? Which when you pull up the actual executive order, which I have, and I've read through it. I don't know. Have you read through it actually? Yeah.
I have not. No.
Yeah. I mean, it's not short, but it's not long, but it's mostly agreeing to a reality, right? It's mostly Biden saying, hey, contrary to what you've been told for the last 4 years or more, racism is a thing. We recognize that it may be systemic. We recognize that there is inequities built into our society.
Right.
And we want to address those things. And that's pretty much what the order does, right? That's what it admits.
Yeah.
But then it proceeds to kind of say, well, here are a few ways that we're going to determine the extent of the problem, which is really all this order does. This order mostly establishes methods of assessment. You know, they want to do surveys. They just basically want to do research here. They want to see officially what the problem is, how deep is the problem, so on and so forth. That's basically what this order establishes. Yes, racism exists. Yes, we want to address it, but we need to get some data. So we just can't take your placards word for it. We can't take your memes word for it. You know, we're the federal government. We got to do some homework.
I guess. That's
basically what it says.
There is data already, for one thing.
Mm-hmm.
So hopefully they're just mean that they're going to be collecting and compiling the data that exists, not trying to conduct any studies or whatever. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I'm not that hopeful, but yeah.
Mm-hmm. I don't think we need another study at this point. You know, I see that almost as like somewhat of a answer to the whole 1776 project.
Mm-hmm.
You know? So part of me is like, whatever, this ain't gonna do nothing. But another part of me is like, well, I should be as pleased with this as I was upset with the 1776 thing. Right.
Which is part of this order, by the way. Section 10, item C, is a revocation of the President's Advisory 1776 Commission.
Yeah. And so what I'm saying, I guess, is sometimes we, and I do it too, when some racist shit goes down, I'm pissed off. And then when it like, when somebody says the obvious thing, I'm like, whatever, that ain't doing nothing for me, right? But so if I believe that an executive order like this is just words and it doesn't matter, I don't know. Should I have been upset about the 1776 project if it's just words and it doesn't matter? You get what I'm saying?
I think so.
So, I mean, the 1776 thing didn't have me like pulling my hair out. I wasn't like, I had reached a level of freak out already that was just a drop in the bucket, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, yeah, of course. Of course they say this. And so this one, like, it's good. I think it's a good thing. It's a positive thing.
I mean, the bar is so low.
The bar is low. And I think I just see it as a reversal of that, you know, which unfortunately at this point is necessary. So, you know, we'll see where it goes. I mean, obviously I'm more interested in policies that are going to lead to actual equity instead of declarations of intent.
Right.
But at this stage in the game, all they can really do is declare intent. So,
yeah.
You know, yeah,
most of the, I mean, there's a lot of assessment in this order, right? So for instance, you know, they have a White House Domestic Policy Council and they want to, you know, section 3 is defining the role of that council, which includes efforts to remove systemic barriers and provide equal access to opportunities and benefits, identify communities that are underserved by the federal government, yada, yada, yada. And then like section 4 is identifying methods to assess equity, right? So it's like we are doing like from scratch, day one, freshman level kind of work here.
Yeah.
Which, again, as you said earlier, I mean, how much of this do you really need to do, at, you know?
Yeah.
It's not like no one ever wrote a book about it.
Didn't the federal government already commission Du Bois to do this research?
I'm pretty sure Du Bois made an infographic about this 100 years ago.
Yeah, I think we're good on that. The tools are out there. I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to shit on this order too much. Like, I have to because it's ridiculous. But
yes,
I don't want to shit on it too much because they're trying.
They're trying, and it's a breath of fresh air at this point, right?
Right, right. But, you know, it's, you know, I really don't want to get on that train because they can just ride that for 4 years. You know what I'm saying?
I hear that. I don't want to get on either train, though. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah.
I don't want to get on the train where a year from now we're like being hyperbolic and being like, well, we might as well have just kept Trump in there if we're going to get this shit. You know, like.
Which is what some people are already saying.
Yeah. As if you didn't just dodge a genocide. You know what I mean? I mean. There could be an argument that there's already one occurring. I understand that philosophy. But, like, if Black people in America are already experiencing a genocide, this was about to become, like, this, what was on the table was a door-to-door old-school genocide.
Absolutely.
So, absolutely. I don't want to hear anybody say that, like, just even if this ends up being lip service, right? I don't want to be around any Black person saying that since this is just lip service, we might as well have still had Trump.
Right.
That's so uninformed. Like that, I feel like if you're a Black person and you're talking like that, you're very American. You're very, very American. You don't know you are. But you're not really looking at the scope of possibilities because you're just having an American perspective on everything.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there was some shit about to go down. It was about to get very old world, like very not American in terms of your perspectives. And I just need Black people to understand that that didn't happen. And it was like on the table.
Yeah, I mean, and January 6th should have really been the yeah. red flag for you, right?
Exactly, like, exactly.
If you were like, oh, both parties are the same after January 6th, you're an asshole.
Yeah, you need to travel or some shit. I don't know. Watch a fucking documentary.
I was just going to say, you need to get some more documentaries in your life. Yeah.
But then on the other hand, you don't want to use the relief from that to not hold this administration accountable and actually seek progress, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like, I don't want to be filled with gratitude that nobody showed up at my house with AR-15s and machetes. Like, I don't want to just be so grateful that that didn't happen that I'm afraid to critique the direction they take here.
Right. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, no, I mean, and I think that we should, and I say we as not just the Black community, but as Americans,
yeah,
we should all be keeping our, you know, keeping our knee in their back, you know, for the next 4 years, you know, constantly reassessing along the way, right? Like, what have you done? What are you doing? What do you, you know, what are you going to do? You know, in very concrete terms. We need to be doing that immediately, right?
Yes, absolutely. And
anybody who's, you know, talking like, well, you know, come on, guys, they just blah, blah, blah. I mean, look, yo, this is not the time for that. You know, this is not the time to let them just kind of do what they want to do when they're in there.
They're politicians. I mean, they're going to do the least that they can get away with doing.
Hmm.
And, you know, also, specifically, any Democrat in office, especially in a higher office, at once a week, they're just meeting with statisticians. You know, when you said this, you lost this percentage of the moderate vote. When you said this, you lost this percentage of like progressive or racial minority turnout. That's what they're balancing. So staying vocal about issues actually allows them statistically to not try to get Republican votes. Right. It allows them to say, well, here's these people that are vested in this that are going to vote. If I chase this vote, for every one of these votes I chase, I'm going to lose two of those. If we make it clear that that's their mindset, if that's their reality, they'll chase, they're going to chase the other way. At least lean, you know? Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's how you keep them honest. You got to keep that pressure on.
Yeah. I also think, you know, something that we're all going to have to get very familiar and I don't want to say comfortable with, but I do want to say we're going to have to acknowledge as part of that reality is that filibusters are a thing, right? So
yeah.
The reason why they're not just steamrolling stuff through is because they have built-in levers that keep people, parties, from steamrolling things through.
Yeah.
You know, so I know that Trump made it seem like that wasn't the reality, but that's because he was aiming for things that were within striking distance of his purview.
Yeah, I think one of the clear things that I came away with, just like from a political structure perspective, is how ridiculous the executive branch is at this point.
Yeah.
And the executive branch is its own government. It basically, within the executive branch, it almost has its own legislative, its own judicial.
Right.
And it's like, and the expectation is that it's huge, but these things are balancing each other, all with contained within this branch of government. You know? And you get people like we just had in there, and that goes out the window. You can't rely on that, you know?
Right.
So, you know, there's so many different laws written and so many different things stated that just by choosing which laws to enforce, they can set policy. And that's not the design of the Constitution. For all the strict constitutionalists, that's not the design.
Mm-hmm.
But I think for Black people, that really is a bad thing. And I think we were too keen to be okay with it when Obama was doing it.
Mm.
And like the growth of the executive branch is a threat to Black lives, period. Like it just is.
Mm.
We should always like want as many actual balances in government as we can get. That's my opinion.
Yeah.
Anyway, tangent.
Yeah. So I think that's pretty much everything on that executive order.
Yeah.
You know, some more orders that came out on day one. Proclamation ending a ban on U.S. entry from majority Muslim countries. So the Muslim ban.
Mm-hmm.
Executive order requiring mask wearing on federal property. Yada, yada. COVID-19 response. Immigration enforcement policies. Regulatory restrictions on federal agencies. Undocumented immigrants into census. Refocusing on the climate crisis. Canceling the Keystone pipeline.
That's nice.
Yeah. I mean, order banning discrimination on the basis of gender identity or sexual orientation. So there's one for the queer community. A memorandum revamping regulatory review. An order mandating ethics pledge for government employees. Pulling funds from the border wall. Pausing federal student loan payments. Some of us will be very happy about that. Memorandum reinstating deferred enforced departure for Liberians. And a memorandum strengthening deferred action for childhood arrivals. That was day one. That's all the ones that happened on day one. So Black people essentially got one order out of that. Other communities of color, other communities that are not strictly straight white people, all right, caught an order there. But that's about it on day one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Now, I will tell you, just spoiler alert, it don't get much better for Black folks after day one.
Right.
After day one, they kind of fall back on the thing that they generally do, which is we do things for all Americans, and then the effect of it will trickle down to our most oppressed, right?
Yes, right.
So, for instance, and I won't go through every order on every day, but to point, I'll point some things out. So, for instance, all the COVID-19 treatment orders, things that, right, you know, in terms of response to vaccines and stuff like that, that's all supposed to trickle down to us. But as we see in the implementation of the vaccination stuff now, that's not happening.
Right.
You know, like vaccines are not coming to our community specifically. Also, something that kind of operates that way too. Actually, we got to jump to day three. Most of day two was COVID. Day three, expanded food assistance programs, veterans with debt, unemployment insurance for workers who refuse work due to COVID-19. You know, these kind of things are supposed to trickle down to us, but they're not, right, specifically for us, which is, right, funny. We ask for them in very specific ways and they go, oh, we'll just roll it into this other thing.
Yeah.
And it's like, that's a very political way to do it, but it's not a very practical way to address my issue.
Yeah. It's not necessarily solution oriented.
Right.
I think you could say that for even some of the day one stuff, you know.
Mm-hmm, definitely, definitely.
It depends on how, you know, like for us, it's always indirect, right?
Yes.
But it's not nothing either, but it's just indirect.
Well, I mean, it can be nothing.
Like a political secret.
Yeah, I mean, it can be nothing because I should say it usually ends up being nothing.
Mm.
Because by the time it gets through all of the red tape and all of the people that, you know,
yeah,
that are able to somehow get to the front of a line, we just really never really get enough of that benefit to change the game.
Yeah, that's so fair.
I mean, I don't. So it's kind of like the order that we just talked about, right? It's like you don't want to totally shit on the effort, but at the same time, you have to acknowledge that the effort is so minimal that it's not having an effect. Yeah. So when do we get to the second step of whatever it is that we're discussing to where we start actually realizing a benefit?
Yeah. When do we get to start discussing impact?
Right.
You know, when do we get to start talking community impact the same way that everybody else gets to?
Mm-hmm. And it's a trip because like on day seven, right here, there's more the same. Mm-hmm. This one's kind of a twofer. So there was an executive order calling for an evaluation of Trump's housing policies, which is good, right? You do want an evaluation of those policies. However, yeah, we already pretty much know what the problems are.
Yeah.
So your answer to that is to evaluate the policies when all of the effects are already clear.
Yeah, I think day seven makes your point really well, right? So you've got evaluating the housing policies, ending reliance on private prisons, right?
Mm-hmm. And then right, the next that's the black one that ain't really black, right?
Yeah. Then the next two are reaffirming commitment to tribal sovereignty, denouncing anti-Asian discrimination and xenophobia.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that kind of that sums up your whole point right there.
Yeah.
You could just say day seven. It says it all.
Right. Right. And it's a trip because it's like, I mean, here, you know, one of the things that I'm always kind of holding up is by the time America gets to the point of understanding what Black people are dealing with and then thinking about how to fix those problems and then actually beginning the process of fixing those problems and then arriving at solutions to those problems, that by the time we get to that fourth step, there won't be very many Black people left to help. And it's kind of interesting when you look at these, like the order about tribal sovereignty, like arguably that one's pretty direct because they're federally a manageable population. Right. You could just kind of look at them and go, okay, here they are.
Mm-hmm.
There's only like 5 million of them. Well, sure, we can reaffirm our commitment, whatever that means. Right.
Yeah.
Or anti-Asian discrimination, you know, while the Asian demographic is very diverse.
Yeah.
Their presence in American society is real definable. you know, as opposed to black people who apparently are too large to get too specific, you know, or too widespread or too diverse to get that specific. It's a trip.
You know, black people are still politically taboo.
Right.
I mean, you can't say like, hey, yeah, we're going to do this for black people specifically. I mean, you're not going to win any swing states like that.
Right.
I'm just telling you.
There ain't enough Stacey Abrams to go around.
There's not. You know, but then on the flip side, by being lukewarm on it, you're not going to get the same black turnout at the midterm.
Nope.
And so, I don't know, man. I've been on a kick lately where I just really feel like I like critiquing politicians. I like critiquing policy. All of that is important work. I just don't want to leave out a critique of American society itself with that. You can't fully speak to a politician's intentions because of what the statistics bear out on how average Americans respond to direct action to help black people. Even Obama couldn't do it, you know?
Yeah.
He couldn't do it almost more than Biden can't do it. And the other thing you were saying, like, by the time you get there this way, even when we start to feel a difference, then there'll be a Republican in office.
Right.
You know?
Yeah.
It's a rough cycle. I don't know really. The only way I see how to break it is to just convince black people that we have to turn out and vote for Democrats and then yell at them for years while they're in office. The other way doesn't work. This way, it's gradualism. I mean, there's no getting around it. It's definitely gradualism, but it's better. That's better than taking steps back and then all these false restarts and all this bullshit.
Right.
It's just getting exhausting.
Yeah. And, you know, look, I agree with your point about interrogating society at the same time that we interrogate politicians. Marjorie Taylor Greene doesn't come from nowhere. Right. She's not just somebody who got lucky and got a seat in Congress. Right. She's like, she has a base.
She has people that chose her over somebody else and then chose her again over somebody else.
Right. You're right.
You want a primary. So you can't just be like, say, well, it's in a Republican area that she comes from. But like, she won a primary, you know?
In Georgia, which we're all acting like is now Democratic.
Yeah. Yeah, we're good now.
Right. It's like yeah,
somebody that thinks lasers from space are causing forest fires.
Listen, I mean, you got a full-blown QAnon person, and I'm like just unapologetically sitting in the seat. Like, she's hardcore.
Yo.
And you know, and it just, like I said, it's pretty indicative of, you know, kind of where things are at now. It's like, we can't sleep. I mean, I think that we think that we got Biden in and that was good, and it's better than what we were dealing with. But man, you cannot go to sleep at the wheel right now.
No, not at all. I mean, you know, America in general is in a state of opposition to black people.
Yes.
So even good people filling roles of power and structural and institutional power in this country, just their role is opposed to us. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, even if they're good people, even if they want to do their best, they're working a system that's designed to either harm us or ignore us. So we have to continue to apply political pressure. There's no other real option.
I mean, that's basically what the black quote unquote order on day one proves, right?
Yeah.
The system is so much that way that we have to take time out of our day to define and affirm and confirm our racism. It's like,
do you really?
In 2021? Are you sure? Okay, that's where we're at.
That's where we're at, of course. Yeah.
Sad, man. Thanks, but it's also sad.
Thanks, but it's also sad.
Yeah. Just to knock out the last 2 days of orders. Day 8 had 3 orders. Those were all basically science-based, climate change, science, whatever. And then day 9 was a couple of orders, one about Medicaid and the Affordable Care Act, and one about reproductive health care expansion. So those are the executive orders to date. As you can see out of, I didn't count all the orders, but easily out of over, I would say, 25 orders, maybe 30 orders. You have one that talks about racial equity, and then the rest are largely to be assumed to be addressing some facet of racial equity by trickle-down theory, right? So as first weeks go, it's pretty low, but that's the count now.
So what do you do with that?
I think you need to keep having this conversation very specifically, right? And do it in a very scientific way. You had 25, 30 orders. None of them mention African-Americans specifically. One of them mentions racial equity, and it is not an order to change anything. It is an assessment and an information gathering order. But it is not a change order on the level that even some other groups have received change orders.
Right.
If you are a transgender soldier right now, you have a concrete change.
Yeah.
Right. But if you're a black single parent on welfare, you do not have a concrete change here. Maybe if you have a school loan, you have a concrete change for a little while longer.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But we ain't at the table yet, is my point.
I hear that. Yeah, definitely. And then I guess then the question is, like, how do you get there? I think this is something that I think Black America needs to, I think we need to update what we think that entails. Mm-hmm. How do we get to the table now? How do we get there?
Well, okay. So let's fix our language. We mean get our issue to the table, right?
Yes.
Right. So that's for all of the crazies who are out there like, fuck a table, you know, so. It's like, bro, there's a table there. I'm not saying you got to sit at it, but we do want our issue on the menu, right?
We want our issue to be front and center. So how do you get it there?
Yeah. There are ways that we know don't work. So obviously it being statistically bad or abhorrent isn't enough.
Yeah.
Right? So just saying, man, this is really a problem is not enough.
I think we have to give up a little bit. I mean, and this is hard to say because, well, I'm not going to say it. So, we don't have to give it up, but we have to get a little more real about it, what it means to have a first. I just think, like, having a first Black president, having a first Black woman vice president, having a first this, a first that, it's good to have firsts, and there have to be pioneers. Someone has to bust through in that specific role. I get all that. Like, that's significant and it's worthy of celebration. It's just that is not going to change the job description, though. And when we talk about stuff like this, we're talking about changing a job description.
Right.
We're not talking about getting somebody else in that position so they can have a little more discretion. We have to change the description of the job, you know? We need to start asking that of our firsts or maybe our seconds. I don't know. We have to ask people, oh, great, you're this city's first Black police chief. Congratulations. This is significant and we will celebrate it. Okay. Now we have to change the job description. Can't just have a party that you're a Black police chief and then go home and feel like it's okay now.
Right. Representation alone was never going to get us there.
Yeah, I mean, yeah, we've talked about that before.
Yeah.
But I just, it's dicey because you don't want to feel like you're sitting on everybody's parade, you know what I mean? Like, there's plenty to celebrate, and I feel that joy too, you know? Like, I really do. The way I experience blackness in this country is different from the way other people experience blackness in this country. You know, I'm middle class, you know? Some people are just suffering and dying because they're black still here in this country. Right. And so to celebrate another middle-class black person becoming the first professional this or this or the first that or that, like, cool. But, like, there's people that literally don't give a fuck about that, and with good reason, you know? I don't know. I'm just saying. And that's why, to me, it's all about Stacey Abrams.
Yeah.
I think Stacey Abrams has laid down the template for change, period, in this country, because black people keep debating change out. Do we try to advocate for change outside of the system, or do we try to be a first and advocate for it within the system? And, you know, so then you have these people who are either getting swallowed up by the system and they can't really do anything, or you have these people that are getting marginalized and then they're getting further marginalized because they're being all vocal outside of it, right? And neither one of them are just having a great impact, but she figured out a way how to, like, flip the whole system onto itself.
Yeah.
You know?
You know, I thought it was kind of cool where she did part of her strategy, and we understand it by saying her and Stacey Abrams, we are being reductive to the workers that went into that.
The movement. For the purposes
of our argument.
Yeah.
Our discussion. She used the strategy that we were actually talking about a couple of years ago in here, when I had made a comment, like, I think we were talking about local politics or something.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, what I would want to do is I would want to go out and get like 5 or 10% of non-voters and just, you know, get them on one issue.
Yeah.
And say, look, I don't care what anything else about you. Do you care about this issue? I need you to vote for the first time, maybe ever.
Yeah.
On this one issue this way. And you effectively change the whole game, right? You basically, you game the system a little bit by actually getting more people to participate.
Yes.
So it's not really gaming the system at all. It's just using the system.
Right.
It's implementing what's already there.
Yes.
But because we're so used to people not doing it, it almost looks like you're gaming the system.
Exactly.
It's like, what do you mean I can play Monopoly with two dice? What are you talking about? I've been rolling with one die the whole time.
Yeah.
So I think it's powerful. Like, that, you know, that they went after so many new voters, so many first time voters. And they were just like, yeah, okay, look, we're not going to waste time having these conversations. We're not trying to meet in the middle. We're just going to bring a whole bunch of new motherfuckers to the table. And y'all just got to deal with that.
Yeah.
Yeah. I was like, oh my God. Yes. Yes. Yeah. Yes.
You know, that's the thing. I think, like, there's a lot of people, there's a lot of marginalized people in this country who are middle class enough and have enough social capital that as a group collectively, they can do stuff like that.
Yeah.
And really fuck shit up, because we're just free enough to make America kind of wish it hadn't said all that shit, you know?
Okay.
Because America's never been X, Y, Z, da, 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 da. That was all just curtains. You know what I mean?
Right.
But it's still written down, you know? And for now, it's still written down. And we have to understand what we're up against. We're up against a group of people that want to implement minority rule because they know that if they don't, other people are going to be in position to start making America do what it says it's doing.
Right.
And they have no interest in that, and they never have had any interest in that.
Right.
That's just shit to make them feel good, make their kids feel good about the country. That's all that was for. That was an ad campaign.
Right.
But, you know, they fucked up and it got a little bit spread out a little bit, just enough to where people can actually hold them to it every now and then.
Right.
But look, if we don't, they're just going to take back all the words and say, fuck it. I think that's what the last 4 years has proven.
Definitely.
They'll be like, okay, well, if all this talk of equality is what's causing the problem here, then we will just remove that. Say, fuck you. And now you get it. Now do you understand the arrangement? Okay. Now we're good.
That's right.
That's their attitude.
Absolutely.
So, you know, in 2 years, if we experience a typical midterm flip and Republicans control the Senate and the House, then in 4 years, we will be legitimately looking at the possibility of Congress just decertifying the election.
Right.
That's like, that's really, that's on the table now. That's real.
Yes, it is. Yeah.
So it's kind of game on for Black Americans. Like, we got to, in all marginalized groups in this country, we have to become a deliberate coalition instead of an accidental coalition. We have to learn to turn out besides when there's a gun to our head.
Mm-hmm.
And if we don't, man, I'll be watching. I'll be in Panama or some shit. Tell you right now.
Yeah, I got to get my, look, see, for real, I got to get my passport renewed.
I will be rooting for y'all, okay? I will be in a different country, really hoping for the best for all of you poor Black Americans.
Right.
Because I ain't, that other way, I'm not into that, man. I don't want to do that.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? Maybe when I was 20, but I'm too old for that shit.
Agreed.
So.
Well, I think that's all we have on the executive orders. That's where things are with that. We're keeping score, basically.
Keeping score.
We all should be playing the home version of the game, right? Anything else you wanted to hit while we were kind of hanging out?
Man, you know me, I always got more. You excited about our mayor taking bold action and bold leadership?
You're talking about the police chief thing? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah, right.
That's the short answer. No. Considering he didn't really, I mean, as near as I could tell, he didn't really do anything here, right?
Isn't this just a microcosm of what we're like? It's so crazy, you know?
Yeah.
We're going to do another search. Oh, didn't you just, you don't have the, you didn't keep the list?
It was pretty short.
You should have filed it somewhere.
Yeah. All that money you spent on it the first time.
Right. Put that on a USB or something. You know what I mean? You didn't keep it?
Yeah, just call that dude up again, you know?
Jesus, man.
See if he's still looking for a job.
Oh, so crazy.
I think that it's so for those who don't know what we're talking about, and we're not going to talk about it long because it's ridiculous. But in Columbus, Ohio, the police chief, Quinlan, has stepped back from his role as police chief. So, and they will effect a new search for a new police chief.
Yeah.
And just so people who maybe don't know, he didn't lose his job per se. He's just becoming a deputy chief.
Yes. Right? Deputy.
So he just took like half a step back.
Right.
All that really means is he's not going to be the target for our public derision moving forward.
Yeah. He's not doing press conferences anymore.
Basically. Exactly. Right.
Yeah.
Which is why, like, it was funny, like, a reporter reached out to me, like within 30 minutes of that announcement.
Mm-hmm.
And not a local reporter, like a national reporter. And they're like, so what are your feelings about this? I was like, well, I haven't even read anything about it yet. I got to get back to you. Because people were, like, online, like, yes.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
mm-hmm.
we did it. And I'm like, I mean, on paper, we right?
We did something.
Yes, right. There was definitely an effect. Let's be clear about that.
Yeah.
However, once you kind of looked into it, it was like, oh, this is just a shell game, right?
Yeah. That's,
you know, they just moved him and they're just going to move somebody else in, you know, and so we'll just be looking to have them fired post haste as well, probably.
Yeah. Right. Right.
So that's what we're talking about. But yeah, man, like, I mean, obviously, I'm over it. You know, I'm already like, what's next? What's next?
Yeah.
Here's the thing. the city deserves, as far as I'm concerned, I see no evidence that the city should deserve any credit for this move. If anything, you should be thanking the national media who, after Columbus put two black bodies in 3 weeks on the books, decided it was time to put a spotlight on Columbus.
Exactly.
And the minute you do that, Quinlan got to go.
Yeah.
There's no way you can justify that. Anything that he would have said prior to that happening was out the window. Yep. Out the window. So, I mean, to me, it's not even – that's not that surprising a move.
Right.
I was surprised when it happened, but when you think about it in reflection, it's like, well, you probably should have seen that coming.
Right.
You know, at the minute that you're like a Washington Post story and – an AP story and a USA Today story, like, you gotta make a change.
It's a wrap.
Yeah, pretty much.
That's like, pretty much your job as police chief is not to make those kind of headlines. So
right. Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, I didn't besmirch anybody's celebration of that.
Yeah.
You know, look, people were marching in the street to make that happen.
Right.
And I do. And I believe that they had an effect locally.
Yes.
But I don't know that that alone would have affected change. You know, I think national news, CNN, you know, talking about your city like it's Southside Chicago.
Yeah.
You know, or whatever.
Yeah.
Affects that kind of change.
Absolutely. Or at the very least, the combination of the two.
No, it's always a combination. Always a combination. Yeah. Right. You can't take away from the protest efforts, but you also have to give credit where credit is due, you know?
Yeah.
And I mean, and imagine how much worse it would have been had there not been protest effort. There's no protest effort. We catch Casey Goodson Jr. and Andre Hill, and then what?
Exactly.
You know?
Exactly.
Like, how bad would we have looked as a city, as a community, if we hadn't been protesting?
Right.
You know, it's very telling that we were protesting all summer when we didn't have local bodies that year.
Yeah.
To point to, you know, we've been talking about Columbus community protesters have been talking about this years. Yeah. So absolutely. All of that effort serves to apply pressure.
Absolutely.
Constant pressure. Right. Which is kind of what you want locally. Right.
Yep.
Locally, you want that constant pressure.
Yep.
And if you apply it constantly at the local level, then you're able to develop it. You're able to generate work and platforms that you can then point to when they say, well, we don't know what the community wants. Well, the community, you know, certain organizations in the community, certain leaders in the community make that very clear.
Yeah.
And you really can't get to that level of engagement if you're not constantly protesting and kind of in people's faces and constantly doing that work on an ongoing basis. So, you know, our activist community is to be lauded.
Absolutely.
You know?
Yeah. Yeah. But there comes a point where regular people have to pick up the ball.
Absolutely.
Because they did all this long time. It still took national coverage. And all they got was this guy that is now the deputy chief.
Right.
So this is the part where you just need regular people to pick up the phone and be like, hey, man, we see what you're doing. This isn't what people are asking for.
Right. The question is, where do you think the pressure is coming from on our civic leaders, on your mayor, on your city hall? Is that coming from the community or is that coming from the business class, shall we say?
Yeah.
Right.
It's coming from the same people that gave space for the police snipers at the Black Lives Matter protests, you know, let them be up on their buildings, you know.
Right.
It's I hear you. I hear what you're saying.
Like, you never want to say the community didn't get it done, but they have masters.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
And once you recognize that your city is basically a huge condo development,
yeah,
and drama is bad for business, then it's pretty easy to assume where the pressure's coming from to,
right,
you know, right, to for instance make Mayor Ginther change his language.
Yes.
Right? The Mayor Ginther doing all the talking now is not the Mayor Ginther that was doing all the talking 6 months ago.
Nope, at all. Right?
That's different play.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And it ain't because he believes. He's not a convert.
Right.
A year ago, they was dragging protesters out of the Martin Luther King breakfast.
Yes.
Right? Almost to the day. Almost to the day.
Yeah.
Right? That's who he is. That's who our leadership is. So the question now is, okay, so you have a handful of them who have changed their language. Why did they change their language? Is it because of the protest? Not entirely. No. The protest is not their master. They're not worried yet about votes.
Well, it's the drama, though.
The drama is bad for business.
The protests contributed to the drama, which was bad for business.
Yes.
Which changed how people who have the leverage addressed the issue.
Yep.
Absolutely. And they're thinking, you know, in a couple months, it's going to be warm. People are going to be vaccinated. You know what I mean? Like, we don't want to see that again. We don't want to see that worse. You know what I mean? So we need you to handle this, Andy. You know, that was the meeting, you know?
Right.
I'm sure.
Just change your language.
Yeah.
Change your language. You ain't got to, like, do nothing yet, but change your language.
Yeah, it's a rebranding effort.
Yeah, man. Yeah. They think they slick. Anyhow, those are my thoughts on it. So we'll see what happens next. Anything else? That might be it.
I think that's it.
All right. Well, I guess that's our show. Yeah. Our show.
We did a show.
That's right. We did it for you in the snow, the snowy mounds of Columbus, Ohio.
Whatever. It's melting as we talk.
Yeah, it's not that bad. It wasn't that bad. I was a little disappointed, actually.
Sorry, man. Maybe now that we're back in the Paris Climate Accords, you'll start getting your snow again.
Yes, I'm sure they'll fix everything.
That's how it works, right?
Absolutely. Just like Superman flying around the planet real fast, reversing everything.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yes. So
we're on our way.
That's right. Well, everyone, thank you for tuning in. Hopefully this gives you something to think about, some things to consider, and inspires you to do some research and some talking in your corner of the world. Yeah, I guess that's it. Thanks for tuning in. Be safe. I'm searching for the cooling at all. Is it my line in silver? Am I flow cold enough? Then my tongue stick to it like the winter with frost. Then I woke up, doped up on life. See, hustle is the motive like a motor that's on, right? Develop the mic.